today, I thought it'd be good just to get some type of discussion going on healthy families. What is a healthy family? For those who have not met me, my name is Tim Walbrecht. I'm from Redmond, Washington, and I'm on the teaching staff here and will be next week also. For those that just came in wanting to know what I'll be teaching next week, I'll find out at 5 o'clock, but today. One of the things next week that I do hope to talk about is the area of depression, especially how it relates to adolescents, the issues of suicide, and what we as people can be doing about that. That's a three-parter that I'm going to do next week. But anyway, today we're going to talk about the healthy family, and I guess the title was Healthy Family, Real or Myth? Okay. I think what I'm going to do first is go through a number of patterns that are emerging, I think, in marriage and family living, sort of like an overview. And then maybe we need to define family a little bit so we know what we're talking about. And maybe even define the whole phrase of healthy. I do want this time together to be one of talking back and forth. I think the last sessions that I've had, I think the benefit of the session was the discussion that the group got going. And I hope that we do that today, and please jump in at any time, which I've gotten to know several of you through the series. I'm sure that will not stop you at all from doing. You'll get in there right away, I'm sure. And also keep in mind that the time that we have, we will not be able to completely cover the topic nor the issue, but at least get something going to whet your appetite a little bit. Let me read a couple quotes to you, sort of set the time. Of course, I didn't write the page number, did I? This one is out of a book, which I highly recommend, either for your church library or for your own. Actually, you ought to read it for yourself. It's Traits of a Healthy Family by Dolores Curran. After you finish reading this book, you will find that if you had any doubts, you will find that you have probably you probably have more of a healthy family than you initially thought you had. But here's a quote from there. It's actually from Jane Howard, who studies families, and she says, call it a clan, call it a network, call it a tribe, call it a family. Whatever you call it, whoever you are, you need one. And then that's followed by a quote by J.B. Priestley. And this one I just am quoting, I'm not even sure if it fits, but I like it anyway. There was no respect for youth when I was young, and now I am old, there is no respect for age. I missed it, coming and going. Let's talk about first some of the patterns in marriage and family living. I'm going to give you an overview. Then I'm going to ask the question, what does this mean towards healthy family? What do we mean by healthy family? And I also want you to think of another question, is how large is our household, or how large is your household? Okay? Are we to be thinking, when we talk about family, or should we be thinking outside of our nuclear family? Okay, those are some questions, keep in mind. Some of the patterns that seem to be developing. I'm one for the statistics, so please bear with. Marriage is still an exceedingly important part of the American life. 90 to 95% of the Americans marry at least once. Most people still connect marriage with permanence and expect marriage to last throughout their lifetime. Age is an important indicator of success in marriage. Teenage marriages have the highest divorce rate, 3 in 5, end within 6 years. People who wait till their late 20s or early 30s have the best chance of success in marriage. Marriages that last are lasting longer today. Interesting. Couples will spend only 18% of their married lives raising young children, compared with 54% a century ago. Yeah, and that's something. Now what do we do after the, what do we do now? Yeah. With longer life expectancies, couples have many more years together without children. In the past few decades, there has been an eightfold increase in the number of single persons of opposite sex, non-relatives, living together. This is one of my favorite. Reported marital satisfaction is greatest before children are born and after they leave home. Huh? There's hope, yeah. The median age at first marriage today is 25.4 years for men. For women, it's 23 years. In 1979, it was 24 for the men and 22 for the women. It's going up a little bit. Yeah, going up. Was it higher or lower in 1890? 100 years ago, about. That's what everybody says. Actually, it was higher. 26 for men and 22 about what it is for the women. In fact, from the turn of the century, the age for marriage, the national average, declined from 1890 all the way about to 1980, and then it started going back up a little bit. A few more. Keep it in mind, healthy families here. And also definition, what is a family? In the past 100 years, there has been a 16-fold increase in the divorce rate. By 1971, the U.S. had the highest divorce rate amongst populous nations and still ranks number one. It is estimated that 4 out of every 10 children born in the 1980s will spend part of their childhood in a single-parent family, usually with the mother as the head of the family. In 1985, more than 1 million marriages ended in divorce. The average duration of marriages in the United States is 9.4 years. Now, when I first read that 9.4 years, and of course, using my skills in math, I figured then most of the people must get divorced in April because that's the fourth month of the year, and I think I was slightly off on that. By the year 2000, the typical family, if patterns continue, the typical family will be the step family, the blended family. If current trends continue, over one half of America's populace will have been directly touched by divorce before the turn of the century. By the 1960s, over 50% of all divorced women had remarried within 5 years of divorce. However, this trend seems to be changing with an increasing number of divorced people, male or female, choosing to remain single. Yet, even today, 80% of the divorced people eventually remarry. Family patterns, childbirth and family size. 1800, in 1800, the average number of children in the family was 8. Today, the average is 2. Approximately 500,000 children are born out of wedlock each year, with about 2/3 of these babies being kept by their mothers. Each year, more than 1 million 15 to 19-year-olds become pregnant, with over 27% of these pregnancies being terminated by abortion. The future of parenthood will include a greater awareness of what the role involves, increased sharing by both spouses in the birth of their child or children, and more emphasis on fatherhood. Trends in child rearing include more single parent families, more single parent fathers, and less authoritative disciplining procedures. In addition to single parent families created out of divorce, more never married individuals are seeking to adopt children or to have them, though they are not married. The future of the family planning will involve increased tolerance for the child-free alternative. Working mothers. Over 7 million preschool-aged children live in families in which the mother is in the labor force. And that now, I believe, is well over 50% of the women are in the labor force, if I remember correctly. Family life in the later years, the number of elderly will double in the next 50 years due to the grain of those born in the post-war baby boom. And one of the statistics I've used in two of the other classes is presently there are over 30,000 Americans that are 100 years of age and older, presently, and the number is going up. The gray revolution has begun and will continue as the elderly increase number and visibility and become more normative and politically powerful. There is also more Americans 55 years of age and older than there are teenagers in America at this time. Social patterns, just to complete this, For 99% of history, people have lived in primarily agricultural settings. By the year 2000, more than two-thirds of the world's people will live in cities or towns. In the next 25 years, on a projected world population of 7 billion, the urban population will more than double, the bulk of this increase being in the developing countries. And this next one is one reason I come to Holden. Recent studies have shown that as cities increase in size, human adaptation is more difficult and stressful. Certain trends in crime, drug abuse, mental illness suggest that adaptation to urban living is more likely to be successful at the physical than at the more psychological or social level. Just a few more. Poverty of the 3.2 million children in the United States families whose income are less than $5,000 annually, 60% live in single-parent families. Approximately one-third of America's children do not receive adequate health care. That's one-third. Do not receive adequate health care. Among 42 nations, keeping comparable statistics, the United States ranks 16th in infant mortality. Mental illness. One out of four hospital beds is occupied by mental patients, over a third of a million at this time, and one out of 10 Americans will be hospitalized for mental illness in his or her lifetime. And on and on and on it goes. What's a healthy family? Okay. Maybe what we need to do is first define family. What are some definitions of family that we need to keep in mind as we do this afternoon? Anybody? No one knows what a family is.
Which one?
Okay. Yeah. Which one? What's a family?
Yeah, traditional, two-parent, single-parent, and extended.
Okay. You have the traditional, is what you're saying, two-parent, right?
Yeah, I assume we can still call that traditional.
Okay. The quote-unquote traditional with two-parent, and then you also talk about extended family?
Yes, the parents do. Rebounding kids.
Kids in and out of the family?
Yeah, older parents.
Older parents? Okay. Okay. What else? What other definitions of family do we have out here? Or out there?
Usually biological, biologically related.
Biologically related? Okay. The family of origin type? Yeah. Okay. Blood related? What other type of family do we have?
Melded families.
Melded families or blended families?
Blended.
Or however you want to call it, okay. All right, what other type of families do we have? I want to make sure we're thinking, you know, my concern is that we don't have a narrow concept of what family is. I think it's broader than...
We have a Christian family.
Christian family, okay. What else?
Groups of people related by a common cause.
Group of people related by a common cause make up a family. Yeah.
People who make a commitment to be with one another and support one another.
Okay. People who make a commitment to be with each other and support each other, is that what you said? Okay. You have a single parent family. Okay, you have two people not married living together. It's a family. Two people not married living together with children is a family, with or without children. No longer is it defined, that a family necessarily has to have children. The basic overall common definition of family is two people living under the same roof. That's it. Two or more, whether there's children or not. All of us come from a family. Even if you're single, you're still part of a family. You're part of the family that you came from. You're the part of the family that you either at school with or at work with or might be sharing a house with or something on that line. And you're also a family of the whole world, and you're the family of God, and you're the Christians, and so forth and so on. Historically, the function of the family was basically five areas. One was to achieve economic survival. The second was to provide protection. The third was to pass on religious faith. The fourth function of the family was to educate its young. And the fifth one was to confer status. And I'm not quite, and I look at those five and I don't know if there's any of them left now, basically. Well, to provide protection is still within the family, nuclear family, the people living under the one roof. To achieve economic survival, I don't know. To pass on religious faith, schools do that, or churches do that, or confirmation classes are supposed to do that. To educate its young, the government does that through schools, or private schools, privately done, and to confer status. I think that's kind of lost. Usually when you grow up, you go off and make your own name, so to speak, confer status. So the historical function of the family is not a good place to look, probably, for a definition. So what do we mean by healthy? We've got a working definition now of family. What do we mean by healthy? Anybody want to venture out first? I've got my 4-page definition, but I want to hear what other people have too. Actually, it's 4.5 pages.
Lack of problems that can't reasonably be solved.
Lack of problems which reasonably cannot be solved.
Which can reasonably be
solved. Oh, can, excuse me. A lack of problems that reasonably can be solved. Okay, anybody else?
A feeling of well-being.
A feeling of well-being for who? Just the parents, just the kids?
For
the
you're asking for a definition of healthy?
Yeah, just a feeling of well-being. Okay. I tried to expand it there.
Oh, yeah.
Anybody else? Healthy. A new term that is being developed amongst people who work with families is, instead of just calling them healthy, and we're going to talk about what does that all mean, but there's a new term developing called good enough.
Good enough.
Good enough families. And part of that comes out of, and I've experienced this in my work with families, is that there's no perfect family. And a lot of the families that I see that come in really want to be perfect families. And they have the hardest, first they have a very hard, difficult time defining what perfect is. Okay, and once they defined it, and then they put in all of the stuff that they think is really necessary to become perfect, then they realize that the process is really, I don't want to use the word worthless, it's like beating your head against the wall. You're not going to get anywhere. Okay. And I don't want us to think that a healthy family is the same as being a perfect family. Okay. Healthy does not equate perfection. I already talked about this, but in this book, Traits of a Healthy Family, Dolores Curran did a survey that she did up a survey of over 40 items, sent it out to, I believe it was 300 or 500, somewhere around in there, professional people that work with families, education people, church people, professional therapists type of people, medical doctors, and I can't remember what the fifth category was. And she asked them to rate the first 15. And they sent back their results, and she put it all together, wrote this book. But these are the 15 traits in order that these professionals who worked with families indicated this is what they see in healthy families. The first one is a healthy family communicates and listens. Second, affirms and supports one another. Teaches respect for others. That's the third one. Develops a sense of trust, has a sense of play and humor, exhibits a sense of shared responsibility. Seventh one is teaches a sense of right and wrong. Eight has a strong sense of family in which rituals and traditions abound. Number nine has a balance of interaction among members. Number 10 has a shared religious core. Number 11, respects the privacy of others. 12th one was values service to others. 13, fosters family table time and conversation. and 14 shares leisure time, and 15 admits to and seeks help with problems. Which I found, as a family counselor, I found that very interesting, that they would, they had, I don't know if they did it because they work with families and that, but the ones that they saw as being healthy are the ones on the 15, are the ones that when they notice something is going wrong, they aren't ashamed or embarrassed to seek out help from some professional with the problems.
What is the source of that list again?
Source of that list comes from this book, Traits of a Healthy Family, in which he surveyed, I don't know how many hundred professional workers, and some of the lists, there's 40, actually there's 56 items on the sheet. She has the list in here. Also the letter she sent to them out, you know, sent to them. And if I knew that it was that easy to become famous and write a nice book, I would have thought of doing something like that, but this is easy. She wrote a 2-paragraph letter, 56 items, and had them send it back to her. And she had a great response, too, so and then she wrote about it. Anyway, maybe I should have done that, I don't know. But that's traits of a healthy family. Any questions, comments on that? I want to move on to what I call operating system. When I look at a family, when I look at my own family, when I look at my family of origin, when I look at government, when I look at other people's families, when I look at other governments, when I look at anything, I look at it as a system. And I think part of a family life is like working in a system. Let me give you an example. Another book that I would recommend is the book People Making by Virginia Satir, and it's up in for sale on the bookshelves in the bookstore. It's People Making by Virginia Satir, and she tells a story in there about making bread. And she talks about systems. And she goes, let's see. Any system consists of several individual parts that are essential and related to one another when a certain outcome is desired. There are actions and reactions and interactions among the parts that keep changing. Each part acts as a starter to all the other parts. It is this constant action, reaction, and interaction that form the most important part of my concept of system. A system has life only now when the component parts are there to give it. Sound confusing? It isn't really. And then she talks about bread. You put yeast, flour, water, and sugar together and you have bread. The bread isn't like any of its ingredients, that it consists of all of them. And steam isn't like any of its parts, but it consists of all of them. Okay, the operating system. And this is a sort of characteristics that I see on operating systems, and it, I think you can take it and put it towards a family, and I think you can take it and put it against any other system that we have. I think an operating system consists of about 5 different parts. 6. One is that there's a purpose or goal. In other words, ask your question, why does the system exist in the first place? And in families, no matter what their size, I think there is a purpose, is to grow new people and to further the growth of those already in the family. Okay, so the operating system has to have a purpose and a goal. Now, I did use the comment, I think, in the session on adolescence, that the goal of parenting is basically twofold. One is to raise emotionally stable children that are able to leave the home, and the second goal of parenting is to preserve the sanity of the parents. And those are the two goals. Another operating system, there are essential parts to this system. In the bread, of course, you had all the ingredients. In a family, you have adults and you have children, or just adults. You have males, you have females, integral parts. A third one is there's an order to the parts working. Okay, you mix up certain things for the bread in certain levels. You know, you can't throw in a whole big box of yeast, you'll have a whole big piece of bread. But in families, this includes such things as rules and communication and level of self-esteem, and boundaries within the family unit and rituals and so forth. So there's a certain order to the parts working. There's a means to start the system. In the bread, the means to start is you mix it together and you stick it in the oven and it becomes bread. I'm sure that was that easy. Whenever I tried it, it doesn't work. But in a family, the system is started by usually by a male and female getting together sexually. Of course, modern science is, I believe, starting to change some of that. And we're going, you know, we can get in a big discussion on the ethics and morals of that whole issue. A fifth characteristic, power or means of maintaining the energy so that the parts can work. There's power or means of maintaining energy. A system has energy. Family system has energy, and it is all based on such things as food and shelter and air and water and activity and beliefs about the emotional and intellectual and physical and social and spiritual lives of each of the members and how they work together. And the sixth one is there. Characteristic is that there's a way of dealing with changes from the outside. And in family, this is relating to the new and the different. And this is where we get into a real, I think, well, what I like to call, and I'm not the only one who calls this, but it's a system called, you either are in an open system or a closed system. And depending on how a family reacts to change, will determine if the family is an open system and a closed system. And the open system definitely is the most healthiest. The closed system is not the healthiest. Let me give you some definitions of open and closed. The main difference between open and closed is the specific reaction to change from the outside. And basically change, there's two types of change. There's anticipated change, such as change that we anticipate when, let's say we have children grow up and we anticipate that they're going to go to college, that's going to bring a change in the nest, in the family. A change of our work or job situation, these are anticipated. Or marriage of someone, that's anticipated, that's, you know, pretty well planned out. The unanticipated might be a sudden job loss or a chronic illness or a premature death. Well, that's a type of unanticipated change. How the family as a system reacts to that determines if it's open or closed. All change involves loss. And where there is loss, there is grief. And how the family grieves will determine how, I believe, indicates how healthy the family is. Let me give you some definition of open and closed. And then think not only, as I read these, think not only as family. You can think about your family of origin. You can think about the family you work with. You can think about Holden. You can think about government. You can think about the family you now live with. Anything on that line, okay? An open system provides for change. A closed system provides for little or no change. The open system offers choices and depends on successfully meeting reality for its continuing life. The closed system depends on law and order and edicts and operates through force, both physically or psychologically. The closed system is based on sets of beliefs, which are few but very powerful. And few of these beliefs, and this is in no way totally conclusive, a few of these beliefs are that the person, whether it be male or female, adult or child, or the situation that is being lived, is basically evil and has to continually be controlled to be good. Okay, we have to keep our clamps on the child to keep him or her good. A closed system, another belief, is that relationships have to be regulated by force. Okay, a closed system is one that there is one right way, and the one with the most power has it, okay, and dictates it. This is my way, and this is the right way. And the fourth one is there is always someone who knows what is best for you. In other words, in closed systems, self-worth or self-esteem is secondary to power and performance. Actions are subject to the whims of the boss, and change is resisted. In open systems, basically the opposite. Self-worth is primary, with power and performance related to it. In other words, when if someone in studies in self-esteem, and there's wonderful books on self-esteem up in the bookstore, your child's self-esteem is one of them that I've seen up there. But studies in your of self-esteem indicate that if a person has a, you know, good self-image, good self-esteem, they're going to have natural power. But it isn't going to be forced power, because forced power comes from a feeling of being inadequate, thereupon I have to use my power. And a person with a high level of self-esteem doesn't need to do that. They are comfortable with shared power, they are comfortable with someone else being in charge, and they have no problem with being in charge themselves. Okay, another one is actions are the outcome of reality. That's another one for an open system. And change is welcomed and considered normal and desirable. And also in the open system, communication, the system itself, and the rules of the system are all related. Which means, as a system, be it family, government, whatever, travels through this life together, day after day, the boundaries, the rules are always changing. There's negotiation. There's discussion. In a family, the rules for a 12-year-old are different or should be different than the rules for a 15 or 16-year-old. The rules for a 6-year-old are going to be different than a 16-year-old. The rules for mom and dad might be different too, for that matter. Okay. If the family is able to grieve, it is more able to adapt to change. Change is inevitable. And I believe, personally, that change is quite good. Any questions on those? Any comments? I know it's 4 o'clock or 4:30 in the afternoon, and on a Saturday afternoon, and the like. Healthy families. Any response so far?
I think most of change has to be somewhat gradual to be acceptable.
Okay. Gradual change.
Yes.
Okay.
Normal progression.
Okay. Some changes does not come that way. Say.
No.
Some of it comes just like that.
So many of them can't be accepted because of it, though.
Yeah.
People aren't ready for it.
We tend to, and I believe as individuals and as families, tend to be a little apprehensive, to say the least, of change. And probably downright fearful at times. And studies on families indicate that American families still tend to be very conservative families, and ones that will adapt to change, but not in, they're not all that open to it. It depends on what size and how it comes. Anybody else? Yes?
Don't you think that our generation had our parents raised us in a closed system, more or less, and now the pendulum is swinging, so we're raising our children in an open system. I guess what I'm saying is the closed family system, when I think about father and mother, we did things and we really didn't question. There was no talking back and all of this kind of thing, and now, and I guess what I'm saying is the closed system sounds really real negative, and it worked in our day. We didn't turn out so bad, but that system does not work today. So it's more of an open system. I mean, I don't know. I think it's the child rearing has certainly changed. Times have changed.
Times are changing.
The closed system might have worked in the old days, but it certainly doesn't work these days. I guess what I'm saying is I don't think we turned out so bad. But what if, but
that's your opinion, right?
Right.
I want to make that clear.
She's right for kids. She's
really good. Change. Yeah.
But it's hard to, I mean, it is hard, I think, in a way to adapt. I mean, we have to be more open with our kids. And, you know, I kind of look at our kids and what I was like at that time, and it's really hard. Sometimes I get really peeved or angry because, I don't know. I guess I should, you should be more accepting, but it's definitely...
Because you feel like you missed that, you couldn't do anything with your kids, do you?
But you raised an interesting question, which I'd like to answer. Years ago, what shall we say, 20, 30 years ago?
That's fine.
I'm a poor judge of age, and I don't want to push it, you know. Were we raised in more of a closed system that I've described or an open system?
Murder, just like my grandchildren.
good grandparents always say that.
Well, does every generation become more open?
20% of the population was urban and 80% was agrarian. In other words, 80% of the people in the park. Then I don't know for sure what to call that. In a way, it's a very open system because each person is directly responsible. The cow's got to be milked, the chicken's got to be eggs picked up, but it got to be fed. And in a way, that was an open system, and yet it didn't have. In a way, maybe it's closed too because they're more authoritarian and so forth. So I don't know what to call that. I'm confused over that.
I think what you need to look at is probably three areas. You can look at a whole list of areas in family, but I would look at basically three: what the communication patterns are, and you can do it now or you can think back, whatever. I think you need to look at what the rules and boundaries are in the family. Are they flexible? Are they negotiable? Are there distinct boundaries between the roles? A lot of families that I see come in where, this is a make-believe family here. I was going to say hypothetical, but I couldn't say it. I just did. Anyway, let's say father, mother come in, okay, and there's three kids. And a lot of times what you see in this situation is three adults and two kids, because the boundaries are not distinct. In other words, they have pulled in a third, one of the children, into the conflict between mom and dad, and have tried to make that other child an adult responsibilities. You see this a lot too when one of the parents dies. Then the oldest will take on the role of either mom or dad. Okay, and sometimes and that's more than just helping around the house. Okay, that's a psychological costume that they put on, and sometimes it's thrust on them by the surviving parent. And then the third area, let's see, what did I say? Communication, then I said rules, regulations, and boundaries. And then I would also take a look at the self-esteem level of the individuals involved in the system. And if you can get some positiveness from those three areas, or an idea that within those three areas we are able to work at this to make those good, then I think you're looking at a fairly open system. If any of those are on the breakdown or whatever you want to call it, then I think you're looking at more of a closed system. I don't know if see, I'm thinking back when I was raised 10 years ago. I told you I'm a poor judge of age. And then I look at the definitions, you know. And to be honest, at times I think it operated very well as an open system, and at times I think it became quite closed. But I remember some of the benefits. I remember my mother went back to work outside of the home in 1957, 58, which really wasn't. You know, you just didn't do that. She also sat down with me and read through a book that she was writing on sex education. I was like in junior high, I think, sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, and tried to read through that with the diagrams. I thought it was quite boring, and I also told her I already knew that, which kind of shocked her, but part of that was because I would rather go outside and play than hear about that stuff anyway. So that aspect for me was open. But I remember times where it didn't feel quite as open. So I think it might be individual. There's a hand over here. Yes.
Well, if it's, you know, if you're saying that the systems now are more open, the statistics don't point to that. I work with a lot of families as a teacher, and I see like you said, mixed roles all over the place, children parenting their parents or on their own totally, to just at a survival level, and parents in denial of any problems that exist, and children with no rules or boundaries, but parents who are overindulging to compensate for the guilt they feel for not being able to give. I don't know how many times I said, if you can't do anything else, take a book and sit with your child and read this book, and they cannot do it. It's, you know, that's like asking...
Because one out of five adults can't read, but that's beside the point. No, that's a true statistic. One out of five adults has a reading problem.
But they, you know, it's just a basic nurturing thing that happened, maybe because we didn't have all of the distractions in our life or whatever. If you're in an agrarian society, the family is at least present together in the evening or on the farm working together and with each other. And they're rarely with one another. They're with sitters or they're...
Which could be also the TV set.
Yeah, and the appearance of communication is real easy to portray to others.
Okay. Someone else, hand their hand up.
Yeah. Is some of this open, close feelings the result of education and industrialization, or urbanization versus agrarianism movements?
So what you're asking is, since it is most of this from the Industrial Revolution, as opposed to agrarian?
if the farm society or the agrarian society is more open, I think maybe somewhere and somewhere, then as people got caught up in the industrialization, moved to urban areas and so forth, is that about the time that things started to close up? And now maybe because of other societal changes that are opening up again?
Boy, that's a good question. I don't know. As you were saying that, I was thinking back to my grandparents and their parents, who I did not know, but heard some stories about. And then I look at my mom's family, and then, our family. So I'm running that through, and I really don't know. It's just, I think a lot of it has to do, though, since the turn of the century, or in the industrialization, I think that has put stress on families, no doubt, and that whole system. And like I mentioned at the adolescence session, we've only had the whole idea of adolescence has only been around since the early 40s because of a stroke of a pen. FDR did away with certain laws, and we have adolescence then, because you were a child to 16, and from 16 on you were an adult. So, that's new for us. Living in an industrialized world is, in the history of the whole world, it's just a small little percent of our time. I'm not answering your question because I basically don't know for sure.
I'm not sure anybody really has.
And then what is the knowledge explosion that we are in about? Some futurists and sociologists are saying this is going to be even bigger and better and greater, and then the whole industrial revolution of the 1800s, this whole computer age.
Right.
It's just going to blow everything sky high. And what's that going to do? Well, science is already talking what it's going to do. You have test tube babies, you have implantation, or whatever it's called. Thank you.
Thank you.
Things like, all that scientific aspect. Yeah. That's going to change. We used to laugh at a song back in the 60s where it talked about someday you'll be able to choose your baby from the bottom of a test tube. Well, that's what they're moving towards. And what impact is that going to have on systems? What's that going to have on immediate family too? Anybody else? Over here. From Brazil.
Yes, I would like to know, in Brazil, 30, 20 years ago, the family were much bigger than they are now. In some place in a rural area, grandparents, parents, and children are living together.
Mm-hmm.
And then I suppose the family was much opener than now. And how was and how is now in the United States? I don't know. I think we lost very much when grandparents are not anymore together. Mm-hmm. And years ago, the difference in the age of children was so big, with families having 20 years old children and babies, and they live all together. And now we have average two children, then maybe 2 or 3 years difference between them, and grandparents live in another city or in hospital.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How was and how is now in the United States?
It's basically how you've explained it, I think, and I think, yeah,
mm-hmm.
same thing, and I think that's one of disadvantages that we are living in now, is that loss of that extended family.
Yes.
And there are several writers that have written about that and talk about that. We are a society of losses, and we've lost that. We have actually lost what it means to be family, because the stress on the family used to be shared. It used to be shared by elder relatives living close by. It used to be shared by grandparents. If you had a difficulty in your family, you could run, if they weren't living with you, you could run down the street, you know, and talk with grandma, grandpa about it, or run to a brother or sister. Nowadays, so many of the family is so extended. You know, we're having a family reunion for my wife's, Freudian slip there, from my wife's side this summer in Colorado, and we have people coming from New York, and from Washington, and from California, Colorado, Nebraska, Missouri, and da-da-da. Everybody just kind of spread out. Which, right, you know, this reminds me too that when I was, my grandparents lived on one block, and when the oldest son got married, he moved three houses down. The next oldest son moved across the street. My mother left town. And then the next brother, the youngest, she left town because she went to school, which is, I'll have to ask my mother about it. She was the only of the four, the only girl, and she went to college. You know, the other three went into the family business. And then the youngest one was the rebel, and he took off for all over the land. But they lived on the same block for years. You know, and it wasn't until just before my grandfather died that the second youngest built his own home and moved away. And then the other one waited until grandfather died, and then he felt he could move away. You know, and they were both in their 50s when they did that. But that extended family, I think we've really lost something. I think part of the stress that families are under is the fact that we don't have that family of origin, you know, right there, kind of aspect. We move around. A couple hands went out in the back, fight it up. What?
In the 30s, my uncle moved from the Midwest to Sacramento. He bought land. He and the four kids lived five houses in a row. And they lived there for many years until the town of Sacramento joined them, and then they made a fortune when they turned it into a shopping center, and they all bought new houses.
Oh.
Then they scattered. By then they were older. But as they grew up, the parents and four children and the families right in a row. I think I'd hate that.
And one of the losses in this is, without the kids being involved with the grandparents or the elderly, however you want to call it, the wise group, the wise generation, without the kids being involved with the wise generation, you know, we lose that, and we also lose, you know, what scares me is we lose a sense of caring, because it's my children's generation that's going to be called upon to care for my generation, and if they don't get that experience, you know, what are we going to do? And to me, that's kind of scary. So many of the kids don't even, you know, so many of the kids get through high school and they never even held a baby. I think part of the curriculum in high school should be all this caring. Actually, in grade school, but you know, having them change diapers, whatever needs to be done. But they need to handle little children, and they need to be around older people. Definitely. Another hand was up back there.
Well, I just wanted to ask you a question. It may be too big and open-ended, but just from your experience as a family therapist, what do you see as the common needs for families coming to you with pain? That's obviously a multifaceted question, but what are the common things that come to your mind that need healing, that need changing when you see these families that are either trying to be perfect or just torn asunder by all sorts of things?
Well, I think part of what you said is part of the key. They need to they need not try to be perfect. Okay. They need, and I see so many families that want to be the perfect family. In other words, we don't, you know, our family's going to be perfect. There will be no catastrophic disease. There will be no divorce. There'll be no running away from home. There'll be no kid fooling around with some drugs or whatever for, you know, whatever. There'll be no unwanted pregnancies. We're going to be the perfect family. And so they try to hold it like that. And you just can't do that. Okay. You just can't do that. You're going to stifle everybody in that family, and before long you're going to have the divorce, you're going to have the chronic disease, you're going to have all the drugs and stuff. That's part of it. Boy, there's so much. I think as adults and parents, I think adults need to quit trying to parent each other. In a marital relationship or in two adult relationship, I think the male species has to hone up to some long-term processes that we as males need to get in touch with, and be more honest with ourselves within the family, and more honest with ourselves to ourselves, and more honest within the family. In other words, we have to hone up to the fact that we're not perfect, that we're not the superior of the whole group, and so forth and so on. Things like that. Becoming and maintaining a family of whatever size and whatever generation and whatever numbers, it takes work. There's no easy way about it. I think it can be a very joyous opportunity. You know, I think there's a lot of fun in it. I've experienced a lot of fun. We as a family do a lot. We focus a lot on communication, and we're not perfect at that. And that's been a long, long, long trip. But I think we do a lot of ritual. A lot of ritual, I think, is a key thing. Whether it be wrapped around religious aspects or just ritual within the home that isn't confining, that in itself is flexible. Because once one person leaves one system and goes with another person to form a new system, you've got two different ritual camps to negotiate. Then if there's a divorce and they both remarried and the kids go back and forth, they're handling four different rituals. You know, it goes on and on and on. It can multiply. But ritual is important, I think, within a family. I talked about the other day the conversation, just talking with the family. And I said, if you make it a meal time, make it a dinner hour, and have nice conversation about how did the day go, and this, you know, things like that. It should be open type of conversation. Of course, the problem nowadays is finding that one meal in there that everybody gets down to. There's a family that, if I was to say that they were a perfect, if I was to say there is such a thing as a perfect family, and I'm not by any chance, this would be a perfect family. And it's a family that I have known now for just a couple years. Three kids. And when they sit around a dinner table, and the parents started this when they were real tiny, they started talking about, when the last one was still in diapers, they were talking about world politics. The parents were explaining why they would vote this way and why not. They were talking about religion, what they believed, the struggles that they were going through. They talked about everything around the table, and as they grew up, these kids are on these conversations, and to sit in on one of their dinner hours is like being, my gosh, on the Donahue Show, like, almost, you know, I mean, the thing that's going, but it's all open, and it's wonderful, and disagreements are allowed, and some of them, one person will take another side just to, you know, the dinner hour goes on for more than an hour. I'm sitting there, my food's getting cold, and I don't know whether to talk or not, and they're just having a wonderful discussion about everything from politics, religion, and you know how those two mix, not very. on and on. But that type of thing, with, you know, within a family, that openness. Our time's about up. Let me conclude here. I got four more pages. No. By the way, in the Bible, and I was going to, the only time that the word family is used in the New Testament is in reference to the household of the universe itself, Ephesians 3:15. When it talks about family, it's talking about the whole universe and how we're all interconnected. Just a couple more things. Open systems also allow for times to be alone and time to be with others. An open system also allows for differences. It listens to pain. It celebrates personal achievements. It tells stories. See, the open system will have a history. It will have rootedness. It lives through the conflicts, and it encourages one another as time goes on. The open system allows for individual thoughts, feelings, wishes, and fantasies, and all of which are respected. And the open system has clear and permeable boundaries, allowing intimacy and protection of individual differences without preventing interaction. A lot of words. What I'm saying there is what I mentioned earlier. There's distinct boundaries, but they are flexible in that the system isn't closed. It can allow outside influences in. It goes with change. The kids are allowed to remain kids, and the adults are allowed to be adults, and you know, so forth and so on. So, our time's up. The first dinner bell is going to ring. We went a little over. A couple other real quick things. How to Almost Live Happily with a Teenager is a wonderful book, tongue-in-cheek, written by two parents who are also counselors. They used to have it up at the bookstore. I know it's here in the library. But how to live almost happily with a teenager. And then a book that is up in the bookstore that I would recommend is Family Ties That Bind. Okay, a self-help guide to change through family of origin. And it takes you through it has some exercise in it, and takes you through your family of origin type of thing. And it's a good book to work with, good book to have. And that's all I have, and thank you for coming.